Have you ever started a new project and then introduced it to the world? It's not just hard, it's terrifying. So much work goes into this thing that you're not entirely sure will work out, and it can be hard to make that leap of faith. Trust me, I know. When Troy and I launched this podcast, we had no idea what we were doing. What if no one listens? What if I make a fool of myself? What if no one buys our products? And believe me, all that bad stuff happened. But I'm happy that we took that leap of faith. We had a lot of tools to help us along the way, and one of the best decisions we made was to have a partner like Shopify on our side to help. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from household names like American Hauntings to brands just getting started. Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And what if you get stuck? Well, Shopify is always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support. And you can trust me, my job is to literally try and anticipate how people online might be confused or break technology or interact with products. And I really, truly love Shopify's products. It's time to turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. That's shopify.com/hauntings. Shopify, making commerce better for everyone.
On Easter Sunday, April 13th, 1895, parishioners at the Emmanuel Baptist Church in San Francisco were preparing for the morning service when someone opened a closet in the church library and found the mutilated body of a young woman. She had been strangled and stabbed, her wrists slashed so deeply that her hands were nearly severed from her wrists. Cloth torn from her undergarments had been stuffed down her throat, and later examinations revealed she'd been raped. The police detectives who were summoned to the church expected the corpse to belong to a 20-year-old woman named Blanche Lamont, a member of the church's congregation who'd gone missing 10 days earlier. But it wasn't her. Instead, the dead woman was 21-year-old Minnie Williams, who was also a member of the church. And that wasn't all the two young women had in common. Both of them had known and perhaps been romantically involved with the church's handsome and well-liked Sunday school superintendent, a man named Theo Durant. Soon, Durant would become better known by the moniker that was given to him by the San Francisco press. In the lurid headlines that appeared, he was dubbed the Demon in the Belfry. Perhaps because it was almost impossible for anyone to believe that the brutal murders could be the work of an ordinary man. In the heated religious atmosphere of the nation at the time, it was much easier to believe the crime had been a bloody deed carried out by one of the minions of the devil. Somehow, escaped from the pits of hell. Welcome to American Nightmares, the podcast dedicated to America's history of horror. Through sinister tales of murder, madness, mayhem, spirits, scandals, and sins, I'll be presenting the origins of American terror with true accounts of diabolical witches, murderous madmen, haunted houses, death and dying, and stories of revenge and despair that have been torn from the pages of our haunted past. As you're aware from previous episodes, our journey back in time is currently exploring the diabolical figure of the devil, the source of so many of America's fears. American Nightmares is written, performed, and produced by Troy Taylor. That's me. And I want to thank you for joining me for episode 13, The Demon in the Belfry. The name Theodore Durant has largely been forgotten over the years, recalled only by the most dedicated students of American crime. The Emmanuel Baptist Church has also passed from the collective memory. It was torn down back at the end of the last century, but at one time, it was a place that filled San Franciscans with fear and dread. Today, only an apartment building and a few aging homes stand along this tree-lined stretch of Bartlett Street. But at the time of the murders, the large church dominated the area. And at its highest point was the church's belfry, its bell tower, a dark, lonely room which for several years in the late 1890s became the most dreaded place in the city. By 1895, San Francisco had transformed from a muddy, chaotic town to a bustling modern city that was preparing for a new century. For almost 20 years, the city's streets had hummed with electricity and had been filled with the rattle of cable cars and the thrum of more than 300,000 people who live within its 7 square miles. The devastating earthquake and the fire of 1906 was still more than a decade away. At that time, the Mission District was called a streetcar suburb, a part of the city that was increasingly well-connected to downtown and filled with a working-class mix of immigrants, most of whom were from Europe. In the middle of it all was the Emmanuel Baptist Church, where a quiet, mild-mannered young medical student named Theo Durant volunteered at the Sunday school. Theodore Durant was born in Toronto, Canada in 1871 and came to San Francisco with his parents as a child. His parents were well off and provided him with a good education. In 1895, he was a medical student at Cooper Medical College. He was one of the most active members of the Emmanuel Baptist Church and, on the surface, seemed to be the devout Christian that he claimed to be. The younger members of the church organized a social society, and Durant was elected secretary. He was also the superintendent of the church's Sunday school. There was no one in the church who would have been suspicious of the good-looking, religiously sincere young man, which is why when a young Mission District schoolteacher named Blanche Lamont vanished one day in early April, no one thought Theo had anything to do with it, despite the fact that she was last seen in his company. Blanche Lamont had arrived in San Francisco the previous year. She'd left her home in Dillon, Montana because of poor health, and in the city, she continued her studies to become a teacher while living with her aunt and her uncle and her sister, Maud. She was a very cheerful, religious young woman and was a member of the Social Society at Emmanuel Baptist Church. On the morning of April 3rd, 1895, Blanche left home as usual to attend a course she was taking at the boys' high school. She was accompanied that morning by her friend Theo Durant, who, after leaving her at the school, continued to Cooper Medical College. After she finished class, Blanche walked to the Normal School on Powell Street, where she attended a cooking class between 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock p.m. Shortly after 2, though, Durant appeared in front of the school and waited impatiently for her class to finish at 3. When Blanche came out of the building with a classmate, Minnie Edwards, Durant approached the pair and started talking to Blanche. Minnie said goodbye to her friend and climbed onto a passing streetcar. She last saw Blanche sitting on a bench next to Durant, having what appeared to be a pleasant conversation. Blanche was seen once more, again with Durant, by an attorney named Martin Quinlan, who was watching street workers replace bricks at 22nd and Bartlett Streets. He spotted Durant, who he knew well, walk past with Blanche, heading in the direction of Emmanuel Baptist Church. Quinlan estimated the time of the sighting at 4:15 p.m. because of an appointment that he had to keep on Mission Street. Across the street from the church lived a woman named Leek, who happened to be out on her porch when Blanche and Durant walked past. Mrs. Leek's daughter was in town from San Mateo and had gone shopping. She told her mother she'd return in the early afternoon, but was running late. Her mother was waiting for her, and she saw Durant, whom she knew from church, and a young woman who fit Blanche's description, walk up to the church. Durant opened the side gate and then followed the young lady inside. That was the last time Blanche was seen alive. Around 5 p.m., George King, the church organist, came to the church to practice for the next service. He had just started to play when Durant opened the door leading down from the belfry. Durant and King had been friends for some time, and King later stated that when Durant opened the door, he was very pale and nervous and without his coat and hat. Durant explained his condition by saying he'd been up near the roof trying to locate a leak in the gas pipe and had been overcome by gas. King hurried to a nearby drugstore and returned with a bottle of Bromo-Seltzer, a popular antacid and pain reliever, which Durant drank. When he said that he'd recovered, King asked him to help him carry a small organ from the upstairs auditorium down to the main floor. Durant agreed, and the two men went upstairs, which had allegedly been filled with gas a short time earlier. King later admitted he didn't notice any kind of odor. Shortly after moving the organ, the two men left the church. Durant walked home with his friend, even though his house was in the opposite direction. He claimed he was still feeling weak because of his alleged narrow escape from being asphyxiated by gas. That night, a prayer meeting was held at the church, and Blanche's aunt, Mrs. Noble, was a surprise guest. She was worried because her niece had not come home that afternoon. Thinking perhaps she'd gone to visit a friend, she had attended the meeting in hopes of finding Blanche, but she wasn't there, and no one had seen her. Durant, who was sitting directly behind her, asked, "Is Blanche here tonight?" Mrs. Noble replied, "No, she did not come." Durant then said, "Well, I regret she's not with us tonight, as I have a book for her, but I will send it to the house." The following day, Mrs. Noble alerted the police to Blanche's disappearance. A search began, and Durant, having been the last person to see her, was questioned but was considered, quote, above suspicion by the authorities. Few clues emerged during the hunt, and the police found no evidence of foul play. The San Francisco Call newspaper, which followed the investigation, wrote that, quote, "Police were utterly baffled at how Blanche Lamont, a beautiful girl, has disappeared as mysteriously as if the earth had swallowed her." Durant stayed as involved in the search as he could, even going as far as calling at the Noble House and offering his services in the investigation. Of course, since he was such a good friend of their niece, they accepted. But Durant couldn't resist torturing the family, soon telling them that he'd received information which caused him to reach the conclusion that Blanche had not been killed. In fact, something worse had happened. She'd left her morality behind, he said, and was currently working in a house of ill repute. He would try, he promised them, to persuade her to return to the path of righteousness. Then 3 days later, Mrs. Noble received an envelope in the mail. When she opened it, she found a page from the Examiner newspaper with three rings wrapped inside. Blanche had been wearing those rings when she disappeared. Later, a pawn shop owner on DuPont Street would identify one of the rings as jewelry that a man had tried to sell him on April 4th. That man turned out to be Theo Durant. But before the police discovered what kind of monster Durant was, another young woman who attended the Emmanuel Baptist Church, Minnie Williams, didn't come home either. And like Blanche Lamont, she was also last seen by Theo Durant. On April 12th, Minnie Williams had left the home of C.H. Morgan in Alameda to take a new job with Amelia Voy on Howard Street. Minnie was also a member of the Emmanuel Baptist Church and had mentioned to the family she'd previously worked for that she planned to attend a meeting of the Young Social Society that was going to be held at the home of a dentist named Dr. T.A. Vogel that evening. But Minnie never arrived that night, and Durant, who was the secretary of the group and was always on time, showed up 2 hours late. His excited and overheated appearance was a, quote, matter of general comment among those present. The meeting ended around 11:30 p.m., and everyone went home, except for Durant, who, for reasons unknown, went to the Emmanuel Baptist Church. On April 13th, the Saturday before Easter, a volunteer setting up for the services the next day opened one of the church closets and found Minnie's savaged body lying on the floor inside, covered in blood. Her clothing had been torn from her body, and she'd been beaten, raped, stabbed, and strangled, and rags had been stuffed down her throat. A broken knife blade was still in her chest. The police were immediately called, and a second investigation involving church members began. While speaking to witnesses, officers encountered Charles Hill, who said that at about 8 p.m. the previous night, he'd seen a young lady who fit Minnie's description enter the church with a man he thought was Theo Durant. Officers were soon searching for Durant, only to discover he'd left the city that same morning with the Signal Corps of the state militia. A search was made of his rooms at a local boarding house, and Minnie's purse was discovered hidden inside one of his overcoats. Detective A. Anthony was detailed to trail Durant and arrest him, and he tracked him down that afternoon. He was taken away in cuffs while his commanding officer protested the, quote, outrageous accusations being made against his man. But Theo Durant never said a word. Perhaps he knew what was happening at Emmanuel Baptist Church at the same time he was being arrested. The detective force began a systematic search of the building after the discovery of Minnie's body. It was in the belfry that the investigators found an even more blood-curdling sight than the one that surprised the volunteers when they opened the downstairs closet. The belfry was in semi-darkness, but there was enough light for the detectives to see what looked like a marble statue of a nude young woman lying on the floor. She was lying on her back, with her hands crossed carefully over her chest, a position, newspaper writers noted, to that of bodies used by medical schools in the dissecting room. She had died by strangulation and had been hidden away in the belfry for almost 2 weeks. Immediately, the San Francisco Call dubbed it, quote, one of the most atrocious murders ever committed in San Francisco. Theo Durant was the prime suspect, and from the moment he was arrested, San Francisco's obsession with the demon in the belfry began. The case became an all-consuming one for the city in 1895, dominating the local news and spilling out into newspaper coverage that extended far beyond San Francisco. The subsequent murder trial had all the elements to mesmerize city residents. It had a cast of young characters like the well-spoken medical student and the two young women whose attractiveness was frequently noted by the press, and that he stood accused of violently murdering the two women with his bare hands. The fact that the murders happened at a church and were perpetrated by a young man with all the outward appearances of a gentleman reinforced all the fears the same thing could happen to anyone living in a big growing city. San Francisco, they feared, was sinking into a state of unprecedented moral decay. These anxieties were eagerly stoked by the newspapers, both local and across the nation. They framed the crimes as a clear sign of San Francisco's irredeemable rottenness. There was also breathless speculation about the sexual elements of the case. Had Durant been romantically involved with either or both of these two women? Was this seemingly proper Sunday school superintendent in fact a depraved pervert who'd harassed his way through the Mission District, as was rumored? Durant's attorney called these rumors misconceptions, but that didn't stop the press from running them, and it didn't stop people from recalling such stories to the police. Young women described disgusting propositions made to them by Durant, so insulting that the young ladies who he offended feared telling their relatives because they were afraid their fathers, brothers, uncles, and cousins might take the law into their own hands. One woman told her mother, who alerted the authorities, that Durant had lured her into the church library one night and, after excusing himself for a moment, returned to the room stark naked, and she ran screaming from the church. During the trial, evidence mounted against Durant after a parade of more than 50 witnesses testified for the prosecution. They decided to try him for the murder of Minnie Williams only, for which the stronger evidence had been found. During testimony, it was learned that although Minnie Williams had been frightfully butchered and the closet where her corpse was found resembled a slaughterhouse, no blood was found on Durant's clothing because he'd been naked when he committed the crime. The evidence against him was so great that Durant's only hope was to win over the jury with his charm while he was on the stand, but he failed badly at that. He constantly contradicted his alibis and introduced several implausible theories about anyone and everyone who could have murdered Blanche and Minnie, other than himself. Added to all this was a fascination the press and the public had with Durant's family and the relationship between the accused killer and his parents and sister. Rumors of an inappropriate closeness between Durant, his mother Isabella, and his sister Maud spread like wildfire. It was all stoked by his mother Isabella's cold demeanor in court as she watched her son on the stand. The courtroom was packed every day. People weren't just reading about the story in the papers, they were fighting for seats in the courtroom too. Bragging rights were obtained by those who actually got seats and were able to talk about craning their necks to see Durant and his now infamous family in the flesh and hearing every gory detail that was uttered on the witness stand. The San Francisco Examiner wrote, "So vivid were the stories, so graphic the picture, so awful the scenes depicted that men and women leaned forward with straining eyes and hard-drawn breath, catching at every word, hypnotized by the horror of it." Spectators had been lured into court by the addictive newspaper accounts they were reading each day. The major San Francisco newspapers competed feverishly to see who could attract the most readers with stories that were melodramatic, gossipy, and spellbinding. The Examiner's description of the crime scene, which was read aloud in the courtroom, is like a passage from a horror novel. One excerpt read, "Men with a good turn at description had pictured the finding of the bodies of the murdered girls. They had spattered the blood upon the walls. They had dragged Lamont up to the belfry's croaking stairs. The shuddering wind whistled and moaned about that haunted steeple." As the trial progressed, the coverage became more lurid, outlandish, and highly unethical, with reporters assigning themselves the kind of investigative role during the trial that you might expect more from the lawyers or the police. Exaggeration often became the fabrication of whole events, like when one newspaper printed a dramatic story about Durant going on the run and terrorizing the city, quote, "running through people's backyards in the Mission District." Of course, that didn't happen, but the newspaper had nothing else to print that day. They knew, though, the story was sensational enough to sell a lot of papers. The most often used image of Theo Durant during the trial was his comparison to a demon from hell, hence the nickname the papers gave him. One shocking claim made about the murders was the idea that Durant was a necrophiliac who killed and hid Blanche and Minnie to be able to sexually abuse their bodies long after their deaths. Even though an examination found that Minnie was raped before her death, there was no evidence that necrophilia ever occurred. It was just more rumor and more speculation. But even the suggestion of it had many people believing that a monster had to be hidden inside of the man. It was no coincidence that Durant was compared to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in 1895 in both the pages of local and national papers. Robert Louis Stevenson published The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in 1886, not even a decade before the Belfry murders took place. And that relatively short time, the tale of horror had already become a common reference point for a man whose normal-looking exterior concealed a fiendish and murderous alter ego. The papers endlessly reported how quiet and polite Durant seemed in court with his neat clothes and hair and slightly oddball manners, as if it was a disguise that he might dramatically rip off at any moment to reveal the real monster underneath. Like several modern serial killers, Durant also attracted female admirers during the trial. The women who packed the courtroom became the subject of scathing commentary from the reporters who were there, even though several of the major newspaper reporters were themselves women. One of them conducted several jailhouse interviews with Durant and managed to get what was essentially a confession from him, although it was in the third person. Another so-called sob sister, Annie Laurie, reserved her harshest words for the women in the crowd in her courtroom sketches, some of whom she wrote, quote, simpered and giggled whenever they saw anyone looking at them. She wrote that the women she saw in court were, quote, all triumphant at getting in. They were all well-dressed and they all looked like women who had someone who ought to have made them stay home. Even though she was a woman and was trying to establish herself, her writings fed the male anxieties about women who met a terrible fate when they were outside of the house. There were also women who sent gifts to Durant in jail. One of these was so infamous, she even got her own name in the press. She was a married Oakland woman dubbed the Sweet Pea Girl because of the kind of flowers she lavished on the alleged killer. But with women at the time not allowed to have a role in so many aspects of public life, it's not hard to imagine why putting themselves into exciting events might have appealed to them, even if it seems so strange to us now. In the end, it took the jury only 20 minutes to find Durant guilty of Blanche's murder. He was then sentenced to death. Durant was taken to San Quentin Prison, even as his parents campaigned for their son's release. They even hired a filmmaker to bring a kinetoscope, which was an early movie camera, into San Quentin to film Durant looking suitably innocent in the prison's flower garden. Unfortunately, no known copies of the film have survived. Durant's attorneys appealed his case all the way to the California Supreme Court, but the verdict was upheld every time, and a date for his execution was set. The family appealed to Governor James Budd, but after a review of the trial documents, he concluded that Durant was guilty and refused to interfere. Finally, in January 1898, almost 3 years after the murders of Blanche and Minnie, Durant was executed by hanging at the age of 27. He proclaimed his innocence to the very end, but coolly climbed the steps to the scaffold, and when the warden started to read the death warrant, he interrupted him to say, "I'll waive you that right and spare you an unpleasant duty." His family took charge of the body immediately after the hanging because they feared grave robbers. They tried to have the corpse cremated, but no crematory in San Francisco would accept him. The cremation was eventually carried out in Los Angeles a few days later. but the story of Theo Duran and the horrific murders lingered in San Francisco for years after those murders occurred. Even though the Emmanuel Baptist Church resumed services soon after the dust settled, neighbors clamored for the building to be demolished and the stain of the events that occurred there be washed away from Bartlett Street. In 1906, damage from the great earthquake forced the issue, and finally, the church and its infamous belfry were torn down, and every trace of it was erased from the city's history. And in a way, Durant has also been erased. In 1895, San Francisco turned him into their Jack the Ripper, a boogeyman who'd been stopped before more inevitable damage could be done. As the Morning Union newspaper put it, quote, "In the criminal history of California, there possibly has never been a fouler double murder committed." Theo Duran was the most evil thing that the Bay Area could imagine at the time, predating the monsters who have prowled California since then, like the Zodiac, the Manson family, the Night Stalker, the Golden State Killer, and more. In comparison, the so-called demon in the belfry is almost tame, and certainly isn't the anomaly that he was in 1895. And while Durant may not occupy the place in public consciousness that he once did, his story remains from a time when our greatest fears were linked without question to the mortal incarnation of the devil himself. Thanks again for checking out the latest episode of American Nightmares, part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. If you like the show, we hope you'll consider checking out the other shows on the network and recommend them to friends, family, people you work with, and anyone you think would love them too. To say thanks for your support, we've got a discount code. That's just one word, podcast. And that gives you 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store. Just enter the word podcast at checkout. You'll find that online store at AmericanHauntings.net. The website is also home to our books, tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum. And while that makes American Hauntings sound big, we're really just a small business that's grateful for everything you do for us, because we couldn't and wouldn't do all this without you. So thank you, and good night, and good luck, and I'll see you next time, as long as the devil doesn't get you first.
This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network.